From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the Great Basin, a part of this land that is now the western United States as you know it, toward California. For the people of the Great Basin, there was a long-held tradition that was carried out when someone died. Instead of dividing their material belongings amongst family or friends, those belongings were burned. That was thought to prevent the spirits of the dead from lingering within those objects, and it also went a long way to warding off family feuds about who would end up with what. But the result was that succeeding generations tended to have almost nothing to tangibly hold, tying them to their ancestors. All of which was why one discovery was such a shock. A discovery that happened at the Peabody Museum at Harvard University. We're going to get to that story in a moment. You've got to hear it. And here's why we're telling this tale today. Ganondagan is getting ready to host a symposium on woodland culture and art. They're exploring the meaning of material objects, the history, meaning and impact on culture, and it's our chance to learn more about these ideas. We'll also discuss some other issues related to Native Americans you're going to see somewhere in your neighborhood, probably a child wearing Native American dress or faux dress for Halloween. We'll talk about cultural appropriation, what's appropriate, what is not. That's all coming up, and let me go ahead and welcome our guest for the hour. Michael Galbin is curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan and organizer of the Symposium on Woodland Material Culture and Art. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. Happy to be here.
And Mindy Magyar is an assistant professor of industrial design at the College of Imaging Arts and Sciences at RIT, also participating this weekend. Mindy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here also.
And before we jump to these stories, and again, you're going to love the, this story is just really moving. But before we do that, Juan Vasquez, our colleague, is here in studio with us. And Juan, I just went down and checked the board. It's our fall membership campaign. And I'm not going to be a pessimist, but I will say, we have a long way to go.
We do.
2 days left here.
We do have a long way to go for everybody that's listening in. If you have not made your pledge of support to WXXI and also WEOS too, this is the week that we actually ask you to do it, to just take a moment and reflect a little bit on the value of public radio in your life. Maybe you're listening right now. You're on lunch. You're listening to Evan every day during lunch, or you just got it on at your desk or whatever.
Or my favorite, people who are in a meeting pretending to be listening to a boss and actually listening to the show.
Because don't the earphones kind
of
like,
it's fantastic. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So these are the ways that you can make your pledge of support. You can call us toll-free at 800-295-9994. You can go online to WXXINews.org. You can also go online to WEOS.org and make your pledge. And really, it's whatever you can give, whatever you think is the value of public radio in your life. We don't tell you what value to put onto it. We tell you to just make sure that you give us a call and make your pledge of support. And for those that will, we thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Juan.
Thank you.
We'll talk to him later this hour. Michael Galbin, Mindy Magyar, let's just start real briefly with what's coming up on this Friday and Saturday at Ganondagan, and then we'll explore it in more depth this hour. But I got to get Michael's family story in there. I mean, I was just so moved by it. So Michael, Mindy, what's coming up October 20th and 21st? That's the end of this week here at Ganondagan.
We're hosting a symposium of material culture and art related to the woodland peoples, including Iroquois people, Anishinaabe people, anybody who lives in the Northeast and produced objects, art, material culture. And so we're going to look at how those objects and art impacts us, tell stories of history and culture, tell stories of design and aesthetics. That's what we're doing.
Okay. And Mindy, I know there's going to be different presentations throughout those couple of days. What are you most looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing everybody else speak. but hopefully some people there will be interested in hearing my talk, which is going to be about Mi'kmaq souvenirs basically looking at them through the lens of an industrial designer. Historically, they've been looked at through various lenses. Anthropologists, historians, et cetera, have looked at these. But I'm really intrigued with how they fit into the realm of industrial design and consumer products.
All right, we got a lot to talk about. We're going to get back to this in a second. If you want to go and attend, it's still open to do that, Michael? Yes?
Absolutely. Go to the website, ganondagan.org, and you can click on the symposium tab and get yourself registered. It's open to anybody, anyone interested in Native American material culture, art, history, and even current culture. These are a lineup of amazing speakers, and you'll never get to hear them all in one place at one time again.
Wonderful timing for that. So that's ganondagan.org. Click on the symposium tab. You can get registered and sign up right now if you want to do that. Now, I open the hour with a story that's actually Michael's personal family story. And I'm just going to let you tell the story because otherwise I would not do it justice. So why don't you take us back and take us through this beautiful story that you wrote about on your blog.
A couple of years ago, I was told by my cousin living on the West Coast that there was possibly some objects related to my family being housed at the Peabody Museum in Harvard. There's a couple of Peabodys, but Harvard's Peabody was the place we needed to contact. And it just so worked out that I had some time coming up and I could visit if it was indeed true. And so I sort of, on a lark, contacted them and made an inquiry. And they said, indeed, we do have objects. They are identified as being from one of your ancestors, a man named Captain John, my great-great-grandfather. And furthermore, we'd be happy to host you and come and look at them. Now, this is something that I'd never anticipated. It doesn't happen every day where you discover objects housed in a museum, especially one as acclaimed as the Peabody. Furthermore, as you describe, my people tended to destroy all of a person's belongings upon their death, and so to have these objects survive was really unusual, and it was totally unanticipated. So, as the story goes, I told my relatives here on the East Coast, and everyone decided they all wanted to join my wife and children, my father, even my sister came up from Philadelphia, and we went to the Peabody Harvard, and they were incredibly gracious, amazing hosts, and brought us into a very small room at the very peak of their museum, near the roof. And there was these objects that had laid in storage since about the 1920s. It included a headdress, this kind of skirt, and other artifacts related to this man, Captain John. And it was it's hard to put into words the feeling and the overwhelming emotions that poured out of us as we looked at them, and I was able to document them and study them. And I had to literally partition my brain, the emotional part of my brain, away so that I could actually do a good job of evaluating the art, evaluating the material, which was a difficult thing to do. But I was able to do that, and my family had this experience at the Peabody looking and gazing at these objects that belonged to this person who none of us had ever met, we'd only heard stories of, and overuse the term powerful moment for us that it really resonated.
Well, can you just describe, for example, I mean, we can't talk about every single object, we could spend the hour on it, but what's an example of one of the objects?
Well, he was well photographed, an individual well known and well written about in the Eastern Sierra Nevada mountains. And he was photographed in the early 1900s wearing what they described as a dance costume. And it included a very impressive headdress, which was made out of the very soft, small eagle down feathers in a crown, and it looks similar to a turban. And then standing from the center of it are clusters of these long magpie tail feathers. And this type of headdress for us is not something that any person could simply wear or use. We weren't eligible. It's only designed to be worn and used by a person you might describe as a medicine person, Indian doctor, and they are the only ones who have the right to wear those feathers. So it was really amazing to see. It's the only one that I'm aware of from my people that exists today from that period. And it was kept in absolutely pristine condition.
Yeah, I think you wrote on the blog something to the effect of it looked like it could have come off his head this morning.
Absolutely. It was amazing. You know, the sort of end of the story is that because the material fell through possession in an unusual way, it's actually eligible on our behalf, and I'm saying my family, we could file a claim according to the law of burial rules and regulations and objects related to museums. And yet, it was my decision that the Peabody Museum took such great care of the objects and, you know, had them available, and we had access, and my family has continued to go and visit in the years later to see these objects. They've been so open to it and so great as caretakers. There would be no reason for us to actually ask for them back.
Wow, how gratifying that must be that they've given it that much care and respect. And I also just want to mention that John was, according to the writing that you have on your blog there, someone who not only was recognized for his accomplishments in life, but also knowing as a leader when things were changing. It was a period of change. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So just prior to World War I, there was a lot of interest in the U.S. federal government to actually recruit Native people into the armed services. And when they came into his territory, it was his opinion that they shouldn't even have access, or they shouldn't give them egress into the community. Why would they listen to these recruiters? Because the federal government has done such damage and harm to his people. But the other side was that the people themselves saw it as an opportunity. And some of the younger men realized that they could make some money, they could get government clothing, and there was all kinds of promises, I'm sure, being delivered to them from the recruiters, that they actually wanted to talk to the recruiters and they actually wanted to enlist in the military. And so recognizing that and seeing that his people weren't willing to hear his advice and they weren't moving in the direction that he thought was the right one, he, rather than stubbornly sit in office, he simply abdicated his position as leader and said, if the people aren't willing to listen to me, then how can I be a leader? And so he stepped aside.
That takes someone of really remarkable, I think, moral certitude and sometimes humility to be willing to do that, right?
I think so. I mean, I think it's a lesson for everyone.
Yeah. One more question on that, and then we'll kind of turn back to what's coming up at Ganondagan. So now that you've got these stories of your great-grandfather, right?
Great-great, but yeah.
Great-great, yeah. And then these objects are right there, and they look like they could have come off him this morning. They've been so well preserved. In any sense, did you think, boy, they don't look real? Or did you think, wow, they look vividly real? I mean, there's no doubt it's exactly what I would have expected it to look like.
Yeah. Well, the details of construction were surprising, things that could not be understood from photographs, which we did have.
For example?
Looking at some of the specific species of bird that they were using, mm-hmm. And feather and fur. One of the really interesting details of the headdress is that typically it's built around a basketry foundation, which is made from, you know, locally available plants. And instead, at the turn of the 20th century, they chose an actual, basically a crocheted afghan to use as the base. Which you might find, you know, in any home in America from 1890 to about 1920.
Wow. Is there any part of you, and here's the ignorance in me, and so forgive the ignorance of this question, Michael, but, you know, just reading that first pass, trying to understand the people of the Great Basin, that they would burn their effects, that their effects would be burned upon their death for different reasons. Is there any part that says, well, these effects shouldn't have survived, that they should be destroyed?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there is a little bit of, I do feel that in my heart, I can kind of sympathize with those ideas. The reasons for that tradition is, as you described, to kind of alleviate any pressure from the descendants, you know, trying to take bits of that person's life with them, and the tensions that can create. We know that.
In all cultures.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also, though, that there is nothing remaining for that the portions of that person's entity, spirit or soul or whatever term you want to use, to return, you know. And so there probably are some people from the Mono Lake people who would advocate for that, to have them destroyed. But knowing my family, knowing the people who would make decisions about those objects, I think that for us to hang on to them is more valuable.
Amazing stuff. And it wasn't just you. You had some other family members there. Emotional for everybody?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, they had to go and get a box of tissues.
I love that part of the blog post. And you said, it's like they've done this before.
Yeah, they had one right very handy.
Talking to Michael Galbin, who's curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan and organizer of the upcoming Symposium on Woodland Material Art and Culture. That is coming up this Friday and Saturday. And we've got the rest of the hour to talk about these and related issues. Also here is Mindy Magyar, who is an assistant professor of industrial design at the College of Imaging Arts and Sciences at RIT. Well, isn't that an awesome story, Mindy?
Oh, absolutely. And it resonates with me as well. I am Mi'kmaq, and I've had the wonderful opportunity to visit objects from my own family in the museum collections at the Smithsonian. Before I moved to Rochester, I was working in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian, and there are a number of items in their collections from my ancestors. And what I think is really interesting is some of these items were actually souvenirs and some of the items that I'll be talking about at the symposium. And these objects, which may be considered, you know, just souvenirs and were kept through time and also preserved through the museum, to visit the collections actually with my my uncle, Alan, was incredibly emotional. And so, yes, that story resonated with me a lot and makes me think about why it is that I'm doing the work that I'm doing and why I'm going to be talking about what I'm talking about. Because these objects, no matter how you categorize them, do have extraordinary value to the makers, their family, communities. And it's really important that we hear those stories.
Absolutely. So, Michael, how did you decide to kind of organize a couple of days, people from, you know, different backgrounds and different presentations? Why don't you take us through the 20th and 21st coming up here? Why don't you kind of take us through, and then we'll kind of dive in at times more specifically.
Absolutely. So our keynote speaker is Jolene Rickard. And Jolene is one of the top minds within Haudenosaunee communities today. And she's an artist, she's a writer, she runs the American Indian Program at Cornell University. Much lauded person and well respected in the communities of art and education, academia. And I've heard her speak many times, and when I reached out to her to speak, I was expecting a no, actually, but her response was overwhelmingly positive, and she threw some ideas out to me on what her subject matter might be, and we kind of settled on a very broadly a broad title for her talk. And I think that if people hear what she has to say about Indian art, craft, and its intersections with culture and modernity and how we view them today, I think they're going to be really surprised. She's great.
Indigenous objects as cross-cultural interlocutors. So, again, you kind of gave us that broad look at it, but what do you think people walk out of there being able to connect and really absorb from that kind of a discussion?
Well, I think when we as Native people get to talk about our own objects and share those stories and perspectives and give people an insight into what these objects truly mean to us, I think they won't look at those objects ever again with the same eyes. They will have a much clearer and a much more informed understanding of what they're seeing. It's the kind of information that you just simply can't glean from looking at an object behind glass in a museum.
Next up then, we have, I was going right down the list that I have here. Is it you, are you next up on the list there, Michael? No, you're the next day.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Help me out here. We're just going to keep going here.
Yeah.
And if we're in order, it doesn't matter to me. I love the subject that Michael's going to be presenting on, the last quilled bag left in America.
Yeah. There is a small bag, nondescript, but so powerful in its stories, in the Museum of the City of New York, probably a museum that many have not been to or seen. And it it's unique in a lot of ways, but it may be the last remaining quilled bag of its type left here. Most of the others were brought to Europe and, you know, squirreled away in these collections of barons and lords, dukes and officers of the armies. So, yeah, it has a lot to say. It's a really interesting object because it was actually, it's inscribed in porcupine quills. And so the date and the name of the owner is on it. And all those clues reveal just a really interesting story of the 1740s.
Alan Gutchess is presenting on Brass Tacks and Curious Figures, American Indian Powder Horns.
Yeah, Alan is an amazing speaker and a dogged researcher. He's well known in the Ohio Valley, well versed in the Ohio Valley story of the 18th century. He's currently the director of the Fort Pitt Museum, which is at the near Point State Park in Pittsburgh, and he's done some great things during his tenure. And he is probably the leading authority on American Indian silver, American Indian powder horns, and American Indian firearms.
And so that is going to be followed by Kurt Jordan, who is doing Haudenosaunee manufacture and use of redstone during the peak era, that's 1650 to 1750.
Kurt is a professor at Cornell University, and I admire his work very much. He is defining, in a way, a time period for Seneca people, at least, that was so little understood. He's written the only book on the time period between 1715 and 1754. He calls it the Seneca Restoration. This is a time of turmoil for the Seneca people, the Iroquois people in general. And because of the poorly understood nature of that time, he really has devoted his archaeological efforts at defining it for us and pulling all of those ideas from history, archaeology, maps, and then the tangible, which are the physical objects left behind by these people, and how do they help us understand what exactly took place there. Kurt is incredible.
Then Mindy, an indigenous industrial designer's perspective on Mi'kmaq souvenirs. So tell us more about that.
Yes. Well, I am looking at souvenirs made by Mi'kmaq in the basically after the Industrial Revolution, which is really when the field of industrial design began. And so when you look at these souvenirs that were designed, you can see that the makers were actually really creative and innovative in how they went about making these products. So while some people may think of them not as high art, but rather just souvenirs, when I look at them, I see amazing consumer products that really consider the end user and employ emotional design techniques to create a really compelling object that speaks not only to the end user, but also the values and ideas of the maker.
Can you tell us, you know, Mindy, as Michael said, this symposium is for everyone these 2 days. Mm-hmm. But for people who are not Native peoples, mm-hmm. what do they come and take away from a discussion like yours?
Well, I hope they walk away with a better understanding of Native peoples and intercultural dialogue in general, mm-hmm. and perhaps a better understanding of how these objects are more than just objects. They are actually, they embody a narrative and a story. So I hope that that's what people get out of it.
Yeah, Michael, do non-Native people sometimes caricaturize Native objects, turn them into sort of playthings as opposed to trying to understand the real meaning and impact?
Yeah, they become, you know, sort of fetishized, mm-hmm. and they lose their connection to the maker. I mean, Native objects in general, if you go to a museum, it's very rare that you find an object which has a name associated with it in terms of who made it. You might, if you're lucky, learn the nation of the producers of that type object, maybe a time period. So what we are doing is indigenizing that narrative and trying to resurrect a reality and a context for those objects for people. And it's not simply a powder horn. It's not simply this bag or an object which was sold as a souvenir. These tell stories that are compassionate. They tell they really afford us an insight into that past. It's a little time capsule that we're opening each time we look at one.
And Michael's describing, you know, what you might see in a museum. Go outside a museum setting, and just the way we talk about items like, well, say, the tomahawk. Scott Manning Stevens has talked about the tomahawk from trade good to cultural icon.
Yeah, absolutely. This is such a great subject and a great topic. The tomahawk today, and for most people, is something that gets waved at an Atlanta Braves game. It's sort of this, as I described, this kind of icon of nativeness, Indianness, and it's been sort of reduced into this, you know, literally an emoji type reference. And if you see it, you kind of immediately think Native Americans. But Scott's going to kind of unravel that story. He's going to, you know, share with people where the origins of the object came from, how were they important, and rather than, but he's going to have this discussion, I think, about what does the tomahawk mean to people today. And it's a lot more than that foam styrofoam.
Yeah. and let me just also own something and just sort of apologize. I'm serious. Yeah, I think I was 12 and I grew up in the Cleveland area, and the baseball team, the Indians, which we've talked about on this program in the past, take away Chief Wahoo. I don't even think they should be called Indians, but regardless, that's what they have been called, and they were not a good baseball team, and so we gravitated towards the winners, and the team that was doing the best when I was growing up was the Atlanta Braves. And I remember being on a bus and participating in a tomahawk chop. And I'm sorry about that. I am. I mean, like, I don't know if I apologize to you or just the universe, but I look back and I feel so ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, you know, everybody should reevaluate their lives. And, you know, as we grow and progress towards a more responsible state, hey, you know, we all make mistakes, and recognizing is a huge step to making things better.
Well, that's Scott Manning Stevens talking about the tomahawk. Fascinating stuff. And then there's Dr. Nicholas Stoll, Difficulties of Identification, Mohawk, Kanenkehaka, Knife Sheaths Before 1800. How'd I do? Not close. I tried.
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. So, you know, it's a little known fact that the material culture of the Northeast woodlands, so we're talking about the Western Great Lakes, Eastern Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence River, you know, the Atlantic coast, the earliest objects that were produced from these peoples are now in Europe. And most North American researchers don't have access to them. Nicholas comes from Germany. Nicholas is a professor and an author. He has studied this material. He has access to collections that I could only dream of. And he writes about them, which is even better. And somehow he agreed to come to my symposium and offer his perspective. The European researchers have a unique perspective on the material culture of the woodland peoples. Their perspective is very scientific, and because of its the sterility and scientific nature, it really gives us the hard evidence and more or less statistical evidence that helps support some of our ideas here in the States.
Mohawk and?
Kanenkehaka.
Okay. So I apologize.
It's a good try.
And well, we can all do better. So you've got the rundown of the symposium, remarkable stuff coming up. And as Michael said earlier, you know, these are experts in so many different fields all together in the same place. You've got the chance to register still at ganondagan.org/symposium, or just go to ganondagan.org. You'll find the link for the symposium. It's a piece of cake. Registration can happen right now. They're going to do a continental breakfast and then a lunch on Saturday. So there's a lot going on. It's a wonderful opportunity, no matter your background, frankly, for all of us to learn and contextualize and really start to connect stories and learn authentic stories and backgrounds and connecting and understanding objects. So really, really cool stuff at the Symposium on Woodland Material Culture and Art, Friday and Saturday at Ganondagan. I'm late for our only break of the hour. We're going to come back and we'll continue some of the themes here. I want to talk a little bit about when we see, again, these objects represented in different ways, whether it's a Halloween costume or, you know, sometimes schools, as I recall growing up, you would do these arrowhead hunts or something like that. But I never felt like we had much in the way of context or understanding beyond that. We'll talk about educators, representation on different teaching staffs, whether it's at local levels, whether it's at the higher ed level. So our guests will have something to say about all of that and more coming back here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, let's talk about structures, buildings, historic sites that you think should be preserved or saved in Western New York. Can you think of one in your town, in Rochester, in the Finger Lakes? The Landmark Society is out with their 2017 Five to Revive. They narrow down the list to five every year. They roll them out in the fall with an effort to successfully preserving and saving these sites. We'll talk about which made the list next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you're just joining us and you missed the story earlier this hour from Michael Galbin about this emotional discovery that he and his family made, it's a great story. And if you did hear it, but you want to see more, there's some photography that goes along with the story, even more context. Michael wrote a blog post about it, and we will link to that. So if you follow us on Twitter at Evan Dawson or producer Megan Mack at MMack Media, we'll post those. Really worth a read. Beautiful stuff. And that was the kickoff of the hour, but we've gone through so much here. And before we jump back there, Juan Vazquez, my colleague, is back in studio with us. I like to thank Juan, and this is maybe... I don't think it's biased. Well, it's everybody's biased. But I'd like to think that this is the place where you get these kinds of conversations at length, at depth, with understanding and context that you don't get elsewhere.
And the stories, too. So does Michael want to work in public radio?
I know, honestly.
It's like the perfect, that we start talking about the stories that we tell on public radio. And that,
it's going to shock you that that Native peoples are remarkable storytellers, and they have so much to share if we just listen. So,
yes. Yeah. there you go. So you're listening right now. You're listening to Connections, whether it be you're listening live, or if you've time shifted this and you're listening on the podcast version. Hello to you. We are in the middle of our fall membership campaign, and this is when we ask you to put a value on the programming that you're hearing here on public broadcasting, both on WXXI, WRUR, and on WEOS. And how you can do that, and you may have heard the message earlier that said, listener supported. This is a listener supported station. It's folks like you who call in at 800-295-9994. Make a pledge of support. You can also go online at WXXINews.org and also WEOS.org and make your pledge of support there.
Thank you, Juan Vazquez.
Thank you, Evan.
Nice to see you as always. Just a couple days left in our drive, and we have a long, long way to go, listeners. We're going to talk a little bit now about cultural appropriation. We did a program on this recently, and this made some listeners uncomfortable just thinking about some of these ideas. So I'm going to start with the timely part of appropriation, and it's not just Halloween, but that's part of this discussion. Here's a headline from the Washington Examiner. This Halloween, ignore the cultural appropriation craze, by Tom Rogan. And I will try to read this without snark. Tom writes, quote, educating students on the distinction between what is funny and what is cultural appropriation, the University of St. Thomas warns against costumes which involve taking intellectual and cultural expressions from a culture that is not your own without showing that you understand or respect the culture. St. Thomas helpfully suggests examples of cultural appropriation would include wearing a sombrero or Native American headdress, and there are many other examples across the country. While this effort to make cultural appropriation a thing illustrates just how insipid the left's equality movement has become. Of course, at the most basic level, all this fretting over cultural appropriation is antithetical to fun. If it amuses someone to dress up as a Mexican or a Native American or a redneck, why shouldn't they do so? Whatever the motivations for dressing up in such, quote, cultural outfits, if individuals enjoy themselves by doing so, we should embrace their choices. Ultimately, our society is built on the right to speak and act freely, not the right to be offended. This Halloween, please ignore the cultural appropriation warnings, end quote. I tried to get through it without snark. I couldn't really. I tried. Mindy, I'll start with you. What do you make of that piece? Which, by the way, gets shared, and a lot of people are saying, yeah, that exactly. We're too easily offended. Why are we so offended? What do you say to that?
I'm not sure about the weighing fun versus offense. I'm not really sure if one, if I imagine there's ways to have fun without offending. And that's what I have to say about that. But I think one of the issues here is that it really is about expression of cultural ideas and values. And, Native American, basically many of the objects out there that represent, and I use quotations that you can't see because it's a radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Native American cultures tend to be made not by Native Americans, at least those ones that are mass produced. And so we're in a situation where most of the consumer products out there that reference Native American cultures are not doing so authentically. They're not by Native people. So we're in a situation where the voices of Native people are actually diluted by other people's ideas of what Natives are. And so it's really about a power dynamic, I think, as opposed to fun. And so if somebody wants to wear one of these costumes, they do have the right to do that. I mean, I agree with that. But for everything that we do, we also have to understand that there are repercussions and that that may offend somebody. So they have the right to say something, but I do believe other people have the right to react.
Yeah. Okay. Michael Galbin, thoughts on this?
Well, I I guess my short answer is that, well, when I was raised right, and what I mean by that is I was taught not to make fun of people. I was taught to be respectful of others. And so these the people who are wearing these kinds of costumes, I mean, maybe they are unknowingly really making fun of us, but if you're listening to the radio, you're making fun of us, and it's hurtful. But are you responsible for my well-being? No, certainly not. But if you think about how your parents raised you and what you were taught when you were a small child in kindergarten and preschool, and they told you to treat others the way you want to be treated, then I think you know the real answer.
Do you see fewer Native American costumes for Halloween these days? Do you think that that has changed over the years at all?
I personally, in our neighborhood, no, we don't see them. I mean,
just like sort of the discussion, and like when you jump online and you know, there's like these online kid stores, you know, different costumes, be a doctor, be a police officer. You know, when I grew up, there was always a choice to, quote, be an Indian.
Yeah.
And maybe that's still out. I wonder if that's less.
I think it exists. You know, we see more of it because we have the internet, which is sort of the pulpit for everybody's opinion. And so you become more aware of things that maybe you wouldn't have 30 years ago. You know, on the other hand, we also, as the people who object to these, have a voice as well. So it becomes, you know, a situation for debate. And, you know, if you ask those people, whether you're whatever cultural group you are, whatever racial category you fall into, ask them if, you know, assess that costume, think about it, maybe find somebody, ask them, what do you think about this? Would this offend you? Is this the impolite and uncivil thing to do? And, you know, proceed accordingly.
What do you both say to the cohort of listeners who probably take a view when it comes to, for example, team mascots that, well, we're just honoring, in the same way they may say, well, my child was a Native American for Halloween because they think it's cool. What's wrong with that? We think that's a good thing. Michael?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have our admirers. There are lots of people who are interested and admire our culture. They want to learn more, and we're willing to share, you know, to whatever extent when you go to these cultural organizations like Ganondagan. And we'll share with you what we can, you know, but we're not in the business of recruiting people, and we can't create Native peoples. So to be an admirer and an advocate, I think listen to what we have to say you know, help us in our causes.
Okay, Mindy.
Yeah, I basically agree with that. Be nice and do the right thing.
And then before we talk about Native Americans in education, especially higher education, let's just talk a little bit about appropriation outside of upcoming Halloween. What appropriation means, whether it's, you know, for example, I saw an article about, you know, should you have certain forms of art on your walls if you are, or certain backgrounds, those kind of things. So I guess my question for both of you is where that line may be. Michael, I'll start with you. Appropriation, you know, how do you kind of figure out what is and what is not appropriation?
I mean, I think that a person has to rely on their best informants, like the people that they reach out to. And for every community, every culture, there are lines that people don't want crossed. And, you know, the line for cultural appropriation is fairly well defined for Native people. We have our objections because there's a misunderstanding, I think, in our material culture, our dress, our cost, you know, the costume regalia that we continue to wear. You know, we have rules for ourselves on who can and cannot wear certain things. And these are cultural, societal rules that we follow. And, you know, we expect the same kind of the same kind of consideration for people who are, you know, seeking out those objects. And you can only ask that community what they think about you owning a particular thing.
Okay. Mindy, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with Michael. And I think it is a difficult question. And I have found that many people that maybe want to do the right thing don't necessarily know how to. And so one of the things that I focus on now is actually education, and that's what I see my role as, is actually working with the future designers of the world to ensure that the designers themselves make wise choices in designing objects and products and experiences and consulting different communities so that they are being respectful. So my goal is to make sure that we're not marketing these objects and that we are making the choices easier for the consumer by providing better things.
Mindy Magyar is an assistant professor of industrial design at the College of Imaging Arts and Sciences at RIT. When it comes to Native Americans in higher education, as Michael said, he put together this symposium at Ganondagan this weekend. You've got these wonderful minds, many of them from higher ed. I don't know if it's most, but it's certainly some minds from higher ed, right, Michael?
Everyone. Speakers are from universities.
Okay. So how do you see representation, and is that changing? Is the door open? Is there an effort to really be inclusive and representative, Mindy?
In what sense?
In higher ed. In higher ed itself.
I believe that there definitely are initiatives. I think there's definitely a lot more work that has to be done, though. And there's different ways we can do that. I know that I've had great experiences working with Ganondagan, actually, where there are other Native faculty members, not necessarily in my area of expertise. So it's been really wonderful for us to be able to collaborate, actually, and share one another's resources in terms of doing work. So I think that most of the Native people in higher ed are being really creative in terms of indigenizing curriculum and looking for resources to support their work and in education.
Okay. Michael, how do you feel about the current state of the landscape there?
I think that it's improving for sure, you know, but the problems that we Native people have faced historically in terms of access to education, access to proper education, and, you know, events such as the residential school period, we're talking centuries of systematic attempts at dismantling our cultural identities. And it's going to take that long as it has to reduce, you know, our overall well-being to, you know, to a very low state, it's going to take as long to build us back up again. And so, you know, if you're a person who, you know, likes to see a successful country and a successful, you know, society, then we should be doing everything we can to right those wrongs. And if there's no immediate answers, but I think that we're moving in the right direction. Certainly there are stumbling blocks along the way, but I see progress.
Yeah, I go back to my own childhood growing up in outside Cleveland, and there wasn't a whole lot that I can recall that was effective, real education. I think there's the fairy tale of, you know, Thanksgiving and you know, sort of some of the stereotypes. But at least when I was growing up, I didn't find it, at least in my own memory, to be really immersive or historically accurate or honest. I occasionally remember these Arrowhead searches that we do, and Michael, you're kind of smiling. I mean, does that happen? I mean, some schools do that. I'm not exactly sure what I got out of that. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's a new one on me. I hadn't heard that.
Okay, so you go to these areas where, you know, that you might find certain objects, and
right.
I just don't really feel like I understood any context. So yeah. When you're working with schools, How important is that whatever the object is that someone may either come across or talk about or present in class, I think what the symposium does is it adds this really rich, amazing connective tissue, this context that schools often don't have. I mean, isn't that so valuable and important?
Yeah. I mean, in a broad sense, human beings make objects. And when they're well made, they last longer than the person who made it does.
Yeah.
And that person has given that tiny bit of themselves, a bit of their soul, a bit of their creativity to that object. And to hold it, look at it, and understand it fully, you know, is such a privilege. And that's what we're going to try to do this weekend.
Yeah, I think, Mitty, I think you said that when you think about teaching at a higher ed level, I don't know if you used the word indigenizing, but some of the mm-hmm. lessons, tell me a little bit more about what that means and how you can do that in design and some of the work that you do there mm-hmm. for RIT.
Well, by indigenizing, I mean bringing indigenous perspectives into the curriculum. And that doesn't necessarily have to be in a Native American or indigenous studies class. Rather, it's bringing the insights and perspectives of Native peoples into the classroom in general. And so, and I think it's been a really powerful way for me to teach design, actually, because Native people, as I'll talk about in my presentation on Saturday, are extremely holistic in terms of thinking about these objects. So it's really, I see it as a wonderful framework with which to teach all different sorts of subjects. And so that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. And here's an email from a listener who says, think of the Indian Halloween costume as the most recent minstrel show getup. Michael, what do you say to that?
That's a fair comparison. Totally. Yeah.
On board with that. Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, you're hearing directly from people in Native communities. And again, these are just two people. But Michael, would you say that your perspective is generally pretty widely shared on issues like this? The pushback I get, by the way, sometimes is, oh, well, this poll showed, you know, certain parts of Native communities are okay with the names
right.
and team sports names, Washington Redskins, yeah. things like that, which I admit surprised me. But you see some of that pushback. Anyway.
Yeah, polls are wonderful because evaluating who you're actually making contact with is impossible. So some kind of an email from quote-unquote Native peoples might just be some troll, you know, wanting to spend his precious time or her precious time, you know, changing the statistics on some kind of, you know. So I don't buy polls unless what I buy is when somebody's in front of me, we have a discussion, and they tell me their opinion. And that's what I'm doing. I'm telling you my opinion.
Well, we just a couple minutes left, so let me finish where we started, which was that beautiful blog post that Michael Galvin wrote that we have posted for you, that you can hear about his family story and the discovery of these objects that he didn't even know had survived over generations from his great-great-grandfather. And so what I didn't get of the story or understand was how they made their way to Harvard and how you knew how they ended up from one place to the other there, Michael.
Yeah, it's a complicated story, but they were really diligent, and Peabody was very diligent in collecting that information. And turns out that when he passed away, the material sort of fell to his daughter. And even though they went through all the ritual requirements for the funeral, she held on to the objects, being the last one, I guess, that was there. And she married a man from another community. And when she passed away, he kind of retained possession. And a woman on a trip in the early 1900s, traveling around the West Coast purchasing for the Peabody, encountered this man. And he said, I have these interesting costume bits. And they bought them and brought them back. And they've been there ever since.
They could easily, even if they were at that museum, not been kept or stored in a way that would have made them feel as sort of young and well-preserved as they are, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Feathers and, you know, the objects made from natural materials are very difficult to stabilize and, mm-hmm. and keep in collections. And when I looked at the objects, there was absolutely no damage. There's some kind of frass or debris in the boxes. There was none of that. They were so well kept. It's shocking.
Thank you for sharing that story with us, for not only for this program, but just for your readers. And I found it so moving. So our thanks to Michael Galvin for that. It's always worth the trip out to Ganondagan, but especially this Friday and Saturday for the Symposium on Woodland Material Culture and Art. You can register at ganondagan.org/symposium right now. And you can join them for all of not just the keynote, but all the different speakers that they have brought in. And Michael and the team have worked really hard on that. So, Michael, thank you for that. Have a great weekend, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
And our thanks to Mindy Magyar, who will be presenting as well. She is a professor of industrial design at the College of Imaging Arts and Sciences at RIT. Have a great weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. You too, Evan.
All right. A short break. More Connections coming up.